Last time on the Infernal Brains podcast.
Wolf woman, how come you're biting people again?
And now, the exciting conclusion of the Infernal Brains podcast.
My Blade, My Life, you know, came out in 78. It did pretty well at the box office. Following year, 1979, she released Kings of Fists and Dollars. I don't really know how that did.
You've seen that one?
Yeah, it's pretty good. But like I said, it's mostly David Jong's film.
Right, it's not her show.
But she does have a great scene where she's showing David Jong's character the moves and styles that were inherited from her father. And her father is like on his deathbed, basically. And so it's like this 6-minute scene of her just going through various forms. And I've got a clip up on YouTube of that as well.
Oh, okay.
And that, and then at the end, they fight together and kill the bad guy, the king of dollars.
Uh-huh.
But it's a pretty much a straightforward film and not really like My Blade, My Life.
Mm-hmm.
And so 1979, what happens next, there's one more film that she made with Chen Minghua called, I haven't been able to find an official English title, but the Chinese title translates as Lonely Famous Sword. Mm-hmm. And I've read on the forums that supposedly there's a copy of it in Taiwan, maybe at the archive, I don't know, but it's definitely not available. And it's, for me, it's almost like this sort of missing link piece, you know, because it came out in 1980. The next year is 1981 when Miraculous Flower comes out. And this is sort of the beginning of, you know, what a lot of people consider her auteur period.
Right. Also referred to as the Wolf Devil Woman trilogy of films, which is apocryphal, which has more to do with the way they were marketed in the West. But a lot of these films, which had nothing to do with Wolf Devil Woman, were retitled as sequels to Wolf Devil Woman. So.
Yeah, so it is not Wolf Devil Woman 3.
Right. Yeah. Miraculous. Yeah, it's weird because Miraculous Flower came out before Wolf Devil Woman and before the other and before Matching Escort, I think, which was called Wolf Devil. Wait, yeah, Matching Escort was called Wolf Devil Woman 2, but for some reason Miraculous Flower ended up being retitled as Wolf Devil Woman 3 in some markets. So go figure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that one's also known as Phoenix the Ninja, which one of the copies I have has that title.
And this one, well, what I've found from your research that you've been doing, Dave, is not only is there not very much information on Pearl, but a lot of the information that you can find about Pearl on the web is wrong in terms of the filmographies and in terms of the dates and in terms of the credits. Now, Miraculous Flower, I think on the Hong Kong movie database and maybe even on the IMDb, it's the writing credit is to Godfrey Ho.
I doubt that, seriously.
There are definitely reasons to doubt that.
Yeah, I think that was IDF. When they acquired these films, at least one cut of Wolf Devil Woman, I know they changed the director, and they probably changed the script title on their Phoenix the Ninja cut of this one, or whatever their title of the cut of this one was.
Yeah, so what I do know is that the director of this film is Fang Hao, who was supposedly, according to one source on the internet, the son-in-law of the legendary director Li Hanxiang. But he's made a couple other wuxia films. I can't recall them at the moment, but I really have not been able to find anything at all about him. But this film, as I think both you guys have noticed, is it's a little more coherent than the films that Pearl herself directed. So it seems likely that, you know, he is a real person and not an alias for Pearl. And I haven't found anything about the writing, but it, again, this seems very much Pearl's story. So whether
the credit I've seen her credited with the story, but not the screenplay for whatever that's worth, you know?
Yeah. So the picture I paint in my mind is that Pearl wants to make her own films. She hasn't directed a film yet. You know, maybe her producer said, okay, I'm going to hook you up with this guy and he'll direct the film. And, you know, she, you know, obviously had a strong hand in it. And so from this point on, you see in her films a progression from taking control of more and more of the responsibilities of filmmaking until she's becomes producer, director, writer, and, you know, on Wolf Devil Woman and Dark Lady of Kung Fu.
Yeah. This one definitely has that sort of a lot of that fairy tale fantasy aspect to it that you see in her later films. I mean, it definitely has her touch to it more than what preceded it. So,
yeah, what I especially love the whole scene with where she's training with the happy fairy.
The happy fairy,
It's so funny. It's such a funny twist on the typical, you know, guy martial arts training.
Right.
You know, she's, you know, the happy fairy makes her like hold a mirror for her so she can like inspect herself in the mirror. And while Pearl has to listen to her, just talk gossip about different things. Or there's a scene where you see the happy fairy like swinging on this long swing. Right. And then the camera goes up and you see Pearl standing on this pearl limb, holding the ropes of the swing, you know. And then she's being roasted over a fire, or like, you know, encased in this like snowman.
The snowman. That was I guess she has to go through the extremes of heat and cold. She's encased in the snowman. She has the little slit to look out through. I mean, it's very charming and really cartoonish, which is definitely an aspect of her what we're calling the auteur movies too. I love Miraculous Flower. I'm glad I watched it again recently because it reminded me how much I liked it. It's a really cool looking movie. The fight scenes in it are amazing. I mean, they might not be, you know, they might not be the thing to please the martial arts purist. There's a lot of wire work and a lot of quick cutting, but the overall effect of it is really dazzling. And then they use these very dramatic settings for all the fights. There's a fight that's on top of a raging waterfall, and then they use a sort of a snowy tundra. They're fighting in the snow, and then of course at the end there's the battle with the big boss happens inside an active volcano, which is amazing.
Yeah, that is very intense.
And it's a movie that just doesn't let up. It's very well paced. It's pretty dazzling, and it's very, very fun.
Yeah, actually, a blog friend of mine expressed an interest in seeing some of her films after reading my posts, and I thought about what would be a good introduction for her, and I kind of thought I didn't want to go with Wolf Devil Woman, which is a lot of people's first Pearl Chang films, because there's so many elements I think people can get turned off by if they're not prepared for it. But I think Miraculous Flower is a good introduction for especially someone who hasn't seen a lot of Wuxia films.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty cohesive in tone, and you know, the plot doesn't go off the rails.
Yeah, it doesn't wildly veer from one tone to the next like some of her films do, which is, you know, it becomes a very endearing quality of her films. But yeah, I'd agree. I'd say this is a good starting point because it's not too, you know, it won't induce too much vertigo in the viewer, and it's very entertaining, very well made.
Yeah. So what do you think about Nick?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. It was. Yeah, like you said, it's a good introduction film. It also seems to follow more of a traditional Wuxia narrative that, like, you can see the bones there, but you can also see where it's beginning to branch off, and it has a lot of the characters who are archetypes, and the whole, you know, like the Kung Fu clans are feuding, and oh, who's the traitor to this guy, and people waiting decades at one spot just because.
Right.
Yeah, and then the whole, they all turned out to be traitors and everybody has to kill everybody. And then I like the end screen where she goes down to business and just transforms and just becomes basically each fight's in a different environment. So there's the fight in the pig farm and the fight in the snow and using the environments. And I thought that was a nice touch because a lot of the films, they'll have like one environment that they just use. And like she just went like, well, I'll just use every environment at the end. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, yeah, a lot of Taiwanese martial arts films, it's just that quarry.
Yeah.
It's the fight in the anonymous quarry. And they really had, and there's like a fight in, they used every possible, environment.
Yeah, it's also pretty, the end fight's pretty brutal and helps. It gets you prepared for the lots of blood that's in the other films.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this film is the one where she has this special sword inherited from her father, and which was the cause of all this strife.
Right, cutting blade. Yeah.
So, as you can probably imagine, we do get to see some disemboweling the movie, which makes for a pretty gripping experience.
Yeah, there's one extremely graphic scene of her just stabbing a guy and pulling the blade out. It's like, it's like I got it when you called it the bowel cutting blade. It's like I didn't need the really explicit visual, but okay, if you felt like you needed to drive that home for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I wanted to go back to that scene where she fights her sort of adopted father or father-in-law, which I really love that scene too, because when she realizes or she mistakenly thinks that he was involved in this sort of conspiracy against her father. And he wasn't actually, but she doesn't know that yet. She's torn between her, her gratitude and loyalty to him. And so but she has to avenge her father. So when she comes up to him, she gives him the sort of traditional Chinese respect of bowing with the head to the ground, kowtowing, but does it with such intensity that she walks up to him, she's pounding her head against the ground.
Oh, right.
It starts like bleeding, and she's got this big bruise on her head. And you just feel the conflict.
Yeah.
And it's such an intense scene. And then, they fight. And then the guy she's in love with, this guy's son, intervenes. And you don't know what's going to happen. And it's packed with a lot of emotional punch there.
Yeah. And the scene is a really nice setup scene, too, because it's in the father's village, and he sent everyone away, and it's snowing, so it has like the nice scenery stuff going.
Yeah, and it's like sunset. It's got this beautiful, fairyland sunset going on. It's just it's spectacular, especially when they leap up onto the roof of the villa, and they've got the sunset sky behind them, and they're in silhouette. It's pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
Oh, and I like the prince guy is Lord No Dust, and so the running gag is he keeps getting his white uniform dirty. And
it's funny, and I like that because they definitely in this film they have his retainer, he's the clown character, but I like the little touches of humor with his character. He's pretty much a serious character, except he's a little obsessive about this, his white outfits, which is pretty funny. One other thing before we move on, I wanted to bring up the song which she sings, and I found out that the composer who wrote the lyrics for the song is this famous songwriter in Taiwan. And I mentioned his name to my former Mandarin tutor. And she's like, there's this one famous song he wrote called When the Grapes Are Ripe. And you can find it on YouTube. And she's like, oh, my God, my mother used to sing this song to me when I was a kid. And so I think this is one side which kind of gets lost when these films get translated or, Journey to the West. Is that she got this really, highly regarded lyricist to write the song for her film. And and she used to be a singer, too. And back before she started making these films and had a like an entertainment show where she was the host and sometimes sang. And so I for me, I always enjoy finding out things like that because, like I said, I don't want to make her normal because she's not. But I want to sort of see what's it like for people in Taiwan who are watching these films.
Well, things like that, knowing that she hired this prominent lyricist, it gives you some idea of the sort of air of moment that hung around these films when they came out in Taiwan, you know, that they were sort of the amount of anticipation there might have been around them, or the things that made them prestigious, you know, that you wouldn't understand over here without that kind of knowledge.
Next up is Matching Escort, and also known as Wolf Devil Woman 2.
And also, and in the English dub version, Fury of the Silver Fox.
That's right.
Which doesn't really have anything to do with anything in the story. So there again, there's like some great dub dialogue, and I can't remember. I wish I'd written it down, but there's some line that's like, you know, where she says, "I must be the most miserable person in the whole world," or something. Just as if the, you know, as if the acting in the movie wasn't sort of demonstrative enough, you know, dialogue like that. Matching Escort. Another, I love Matching Escort too, but for different reasons than I love Miraculous Flower.
Yeah, it's got a little more of those surreal elements, like right from the beginning where she has those like iron shoes.
Right. Her father's training her to, which is interesting when you were talking earlier, because I didn't know all this, that she had the father who really drove her to excel. And she was sort of like the type, the helicopter parent, you know, like today she would be like taking track and, you know, doing ballet and doing, you know, so because I think it's her father that's putting her through all these rigorous exercises to make her a better martial artist and a better fighter. And yeah, and the first thing we see is she's wearing, is it like big blocks of iron or big stones that are chained to her feet or something? And she's supposed to run around with these big weights on her feet.
Yeah. That's exactly it. So she's like this sort of princess in this kind of, you know, funky princess outfit that she threw together with like this fur vest and flowing skirt, and then just it's really cool because it's very mix and match,
right?
But, you know, totally her style. And then
this, we should point out, this is a film that she directed and at least wrote the story for, right?
Yeah. So she
or she co-wrote.
She was the planning director, and then besides that, there was someone who was named as the director,
Sima Pang, okay,
which as far as I can tell, only has this film to his credit. So I think the question was whether is this an alias, because I can easily see like Pearl starting doing this on her own and feeling maybe compelled in this, you know, the guy's world to take on this alias, but wanted, of course, to be credited too. So she credited herself as the planning director.
Right.
Who knows?
I mean, I could. Yeah, it's definitely it's definitely believable, because there's not, tone wise and just in the way the look and the whole feel of this movie, it definitely feels like a companion to Wolf Devil Woman. It has very much the same feel. Maybe not quite as extreme as Wolf Devil Woman, but still there's the same sensibility at work for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's sections that is pure, got to be her idea for sure, but then there's still, I think it still has a little bit of a backbone that makes it a bit more flowy, and like there's some parts where it just completely goes off script and doesn't follow what the normal arc is, but then there's still an arc there that...
Yeah, the skeletal structure feels more like a traditional martial arts film, and then there's these sort of psychedelic...
Yeah, like literally psychedelic, where she falls down the well to the magic mushroom Alice in Wonderland place where the old guy has been living for 20 years.
Right, and his whole training, well, because basically it's all her father's training turns to pay off when their villa is attacked by some rival warlord or something, and then she escapes and becomes the vagabond, and then she eventually she stumbles down a well or just a hole in the ground or something.
Well, they're chasing her and she just she stumbles, falls into it. You know, into this brew that this cranky old master has been working on for 20 years.
Yeah.
Ruins his super potion and
right. And then, so of course, you know, as always happens, and this is where, you know, they takes the backbone of a traditional martial arts movie where the hero comes upon some master who will train them for their revenge. But in this case, the training involved is like he rubs like some kind of caustic substance in her eye. Like, I don't think there's any actual fight training. He rubs the stuff in her eyes and makes her drink some kind of weird potion. It all seems like some kind of...
You but know, like, you know that I think doesn't that come in handy later where the
with the
lead villain has something that gives off a blinding flash.
He has like a crystal on his head or something.
And so because of her, her
training, his ring. He has a crystal ring that he shines into the eyes, and that's how he killed her father. And then
I'm kind of slow on the uptake of these things because I have to confess, when we were just talking about Miraculous Flower and then we were talking about how the happy fairy put her on the spit and inside the snowman, and then later we were talking about how there was a fight in the snow and then there was a fight inside the volcano, and I actually had like an aha moment while we were talking about going, oh, okay. You know, like I didn't even like really register that. So
well, the thing is the pace is so quick on these.
Yes, thank you.
You know, there's just a lot is packed into these films. And I mean, that's what's cool about rewatching them is I think there is, you know, her films definitely reward repeat viewings because there is so much, you know, cool stuff going on.
Yeah, she goes for a very go ahead, Nick.
Okay, the ending when they're storming the bad guy's base, someone watched Star Wars right before they made it because the goons are all dressed in white with black trim, so they look like stormtroopers. Right. They're all lined up against the walls, and the big baddie has the mask on, and he's all looks like Darth Vader, and they just run in and slaughter all the stormtroopers.
Right. Yeah, well, this movie was made in 82, so that would made sense. But they had a budget for, like, a school play, basically.
Yeah.
But you're right.
Yeah. And then he has a glove that looks just like a power glove, even though those haven't been invented yet. So
that's right. He's one of the many hooded villains in Pearl Changeling movies. Yeah. She has a very jagged editing style she uses too. I think in the first minute of Wolf Devil Woman, she communicates about a half hour worth of exposition, but you really have to pay attention to understand what's going on.
I have a sort of theory about that sort of fast Taiwan style that I haven't really worked on it too much. But when I was in Taipei, I went to this puppet museum, and that's where I found out about this school of puppetry, the Golden Light School of Puppetry, which went in off the stage and into TV and even more recently the family of this original pioneer puppeteer, I can't remember his name, been the ones who've been making some of these movies, puppet movies. But that style was known for like flashy effects and really bright costumes and using just a wide mix of like music, you know, Western and Chinese. And the style strikes me as very similar to these films. And in fact, before the Protectors TV show, the show that people were obsessed about, it was even more popular, was this puppet show, this Golden Light puppet series on TV, which had something insane like, you know, 92% viewership. And you know, people basically were stopped working. They had to eventually cancel the show because it was detrimental to society. But that's something I'd like to look into, because the Taiwanese wuxia films have a very distinct style that's different from Shaw's wuxia films or Hong Kong's films.
Yeah, and when you shared some of the links of those, the puppets, they look like some of the more out there costumes of the people with the red and blue hair. And
One other bit of trivia going back to the music. So I found the lyricist for the song in this film, which, by the way, there's the scene after she avenges her master, the old guy who, as you recall, he sort of almost naturally dies, like Pearl is meditating or something. He transmits his powers to her. He kind of like, she wakes up and sees him dead. And then this is when she leaves this fantastic cave and then proceeds to hunt out the person who killed her father and who also was responsible for throwing this guy in the pit. So she puts him in this big giant clay jar on her back.
Oh, right.
You know, goes basically kicks ass and kills these guys who are having this banquet.
His evil twin brother.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And basically holds him accountable. Look what you did to your brother. You know, she brings his corpse there. And then after that, there's a scene where she, having fulfilled her duty and completed vengeance, she takes him out to ocean for burial. And there's this song, but this whole scene, entire scene, is cut out of the Fury of the Silver Fox version.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost like, you know, and I think with songs, a lot of times they represent sort of the heart of a movie.
Sure. Yeah.
And so it was cool to read that the lyricist for this song wrote this very famous song by Teresa Tang called "The Moon Represents My Heart," which even if you don't recognize the title, you know the film because it's like the most popular Chinese song in the world. Mm-hmm. And it, again, to me, sort of illustrates the sort of problems when, you know, these films get repackaged for the West, where, of course, they're thinking like it's for the Kung Fu fans in the West. They're not going to want to sit through a song and, you know, let's just cut this scene. But you're cutting the whole that sort of the final moment after the vengeance where she's finally laying her master to rest.
Well, I don't think, I mean, I might be wrong, but I don't think these films in their native countries were as much niche films as they were in the international market. I mean, here they were just part of this very small kind of ghettoized subgenre of films. But I think they're
pretty mainstream.
Pretty mainstream, and it wasn't just about having fights. It was about drama and sort of providing a wide range of entertainment within one film. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I was looking at the box office figures for Taiwan, and like in 1976, five of the top 10 films were, you know, wuxia or kung fu films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it is very much a normal thing in Chinese culture. And
right, I always think of music as kind of an indicator of that too. If a film has songs in it, they sort of cross the genre boundary. It's like usually if someone's trying to bring in a wider sort of a family or sort of appeal to the masses, more songs are a good way of sort of making a film more universal. You know, it's something that everybody can relate to. You know?
Yeah, it gives like something for everyone.
Yeah, and it indicates that they're trying to communicate something more human than just like, hey, ass kicking. You know, there's like something else. There's something else going on underneath that they want to communicate. Like Rock of Ages, for instance.
Yeah.
The Rock of Ages.
the Rock of Ages, except no substitutes.
So shall we tackle that notorious beast, the wolf devil woman? Oh,
yeah, we kind of keep coming back to it. It's kind of hard not to. Did you watch that, Nick?
Yeah. I think that I watched that one second of all the ones I watched in this marathon. Although I believe I've seen it 15 years ago, but I didn't remember it. So.
Okay, what were your first impressions?
It's pretty out there. It's also, I think it's the most crazy of her films in that it throws in so much stuff. And if you're not paying attention as you go along, you just miss how much stuff is in there with like the bad guys. And, you know, just to show how bad they are, Wolfman and Dracula just happen to be working for the bad guy.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it's really colorful would be with the villain scenes, especially.
Yeah.
And like it contrasts a lot with how there's a lot of scenes in the snow where everything's all white and she's wearing the fur color, so it's more neutral. But then they'll cut to the villain pieces and they're all crazy colors, and even the lighting's weird in some of them.
Right, and there are these really weird interior sets, and the villain scenes are, like I said, that first scene where it's just all these really quick cuts. It's a scene in the villain's subterranean lair where there's like a sacrifice going on. It's just all these quick cuts, and there's like all kinds of weird effects that they're throwing at you. It kind of goes back to, I think, what you were saying, Dave, about the puppet shows, where it's just like they're throwing firecrackers in your face.
Yeah.
Like, hey, look at this. Hey, pay attention. And then they like cut the guy open, and it's like cell animated cartoon blood coming out of it for like no reason. It's like, it seems like it would have been much less work to just have a squib or just have some red Shaw Brothers paint. But no, they have like cartoon blood coming out of the guy.
But that's, it's so awesome. That's what I love, because it's like a nightmare. It's not,
absolutely.
You know, it would have given me nightmares, you know, if I saw that as a kid. And that's what I mean. It's like, it's taking it to another level through the kind of creative choices, whether they were due to limitations. But like you said, it would have been easier with that blood to, you know, just do your regular blood squib. But it's cool because it also, I think, to me, it also harkens back to the good old days of, say, even as late as the 60s, where they were hand painting special effects on the film. And it's pretty cool. I mean, I think to me that makes it more effective than just having, I mean, you see much just like blood squirts all the time, you know,
right?
Like,
especially with all the violence in the film and all the actual blood. So this made it more.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah. And it's like, it's the worst church sermon ever. And they go fleeing away.
Right. And it is really powerful. The contrast is, you're right, that first scene is very nightmare. It just plunges you right into it. It's completely nightmarish. It's completely claustrophobic. It's disorienting. And then the next scene you have is there's the couple who flee that horrible nightmare scene. And then the next scene is them running through this pure snow swept vista, and it's like this completely different,
and then the villains are in the red ninja outfits, so they're the color that's chasing them as they flee through the desolate landscape, and it's like
it's pretty it gets your attention. It definitely if you're not with the movie by that point, it's you know, you might not like the movie, but it's definitely a hard, once you get into it, it's kind of hard to look away, because it's understandable why it has the reputation it has, because it's like, what am I seeing right now?
Well, it's funny because this was my first Pearl Chang film, and watched it, Todd, after reading your review and kind of becoming interested in Pearl. I'm like, okay, well, you know, I should finally sit down and watch one of her films. And I'd read all the reviews of this film online, which range from like, you know, oh my God, what the fuck? And you know, this film is like total trash, but I love it anyway. And so I was kind of like, I think a little jaded by the reviews. So
sure.
I'm just like, you know, whatever. I'm just like, I was kind of like that, you know, about halfway through the film. And then the scene, which sort of, I guess, I don't know if accurate to say, it melted my heart, but the scene where this wild Pearl, who's just learning, you know, she's raised by wolves because her parents killed themselves rather than be captured by this demon king, and then this white wolf rescues her, and so she's you know, a feral child, meets a swordsman who starts to civilize her, straightens her spine, teaches her to talk, and now he has to leave to go continue his mission of fighting this demon. She has fallen in love with him and then follows him to civilization, where she's hungry, so she tries killing a chicken, gets beaten up for it,
and
then finally goes to the place where civilized people get food at this inn, and like orders some chicken and fish and five jugs of wine, because she sees that's what they're doing at the other table. So she starts, and this is a great performance by Pearl, she starts stuffing her face with food. And it's this wonderful kind of like naive, you know, alternately charming slapstick performance. And then all of a sudden her sort of transformation complex, which she got from eating this 1,000-year-old ginseng root, kicks in, and she's like, starts scratching at her face, you know, because it's like, you know, itching, and you're like, what the fuck's going on? She falls to the floor, and then she pulls out this bloody clump of hair, and then her hair turns white, and then she starts freaking out and like beating up people in the inn, and I was like, oh my God, you know, it was such this complete turnaround, and this just happens in seconds.
That's an amazing scene. Yeah, I will say that though, this is an auteur project. She wrote, directed, starred, produced it. It's hard to call it a vanity project, because her performance doesn't have a lot of vanity to it. She just really goes there. I mean, that's
I think that's what I really made me respect her is I couldn't imagine any other actress doing that. Bridget Lin, who I love, and for me it was kind of one of the people who drew me into Hong Kong movies, and one of her iconic roles is Bride with White Hair, where she does a similar performance, but compared to Pearls, it's so much more elegant. And
right. Well, yeah, we should point out for the listener that yeah. Wolf Devil Woman is, though you might not know it, it's based on the same story that
the same serialized novel, and both of the films are nowhere near what I've read about what the actual storyline is. So,
but it's true that the Bridget Lin version is definitely more genteel and elegant in its portrayal of that character.
Yeah, I mean, she is like furious, but she's so stunningly beautiful at the same time, and you would never see her stuffing her face with chicken and, you know, dripping wine down her cheek and then tearing out a clump of her hair.
It's a very visceral, it's a very visceral performance of Pearl, and that's an amazing scene. And that's the outsider thing too, because she ends up being lynched basically as a result of that episode.
And then so this is like another complaint I have about the bringing up the music again. And so during this lynching scene, there's another one of her songs about sort of being alone in the world and misunderstood. And then on the English dub of this, they remove the song and then they include this music that sounds like that song Up, Up and Away. It's like beautiful.
Right. Yeah.
And it's just like, oh my God, it's like, what the fuck did you do?
Well, yeah, they didn't think that people would appreciate that level of irony, I guess. But yeah, there's a very mournful song on the soundtrack in the original.
And there's something else, like someone talked about, oh, the editing's so bad, like she goes in this well and then all of a sudden she's like out, you know, in this lake. And I mean, I tend to, especially with her films, is kind of look at them symbolically, because I think in some ways you are in like dreamland, where for me it's like this perfect sort of, you know, rebirth through struggle, where she goes in this well, is like dunked in from well to well, and is being pulled. You see her down in the groundwater in this beautiful scenes of this, you know, bright blue, where she's like underwater. And then she ends up in this lake where she's fished in literally like a fish by the master of this guy she's fallen in love with, and who sort of, I think, has been awaiting her as like this sort of predestined
saint. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely an instance where you just have to go with it.
I mean, it's not bad editing. It's totally intentional. It's kind of symbolic.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing with Pearl's films, is you just got to go with the flow. Don't stop and like try to think about, oh, this doesn't make sense, or
that wouldn't happen.
Right.
Yeah.
This movie about a wolf lady is totally inaccurate about this well. Sure.
Exactly. But yeah, it follows a logic that's consistent with the rest of the film. So yeah, to kind of take issue with that.
Yeah, and then she sets her on this path towards, as you mentioned before, this total transformation of her into the Avenger character, where she comes from this wolf girl who like is all hunched up, can't speak, and finally takes her place, finds out who she was, you know, who killed her parents, and
she's ennobled by it. She actually becomes that Bridget Lin character at the end. You know, she has to go through this really grueling process of metamorphosis to get there.
Yeah, and it's cool that, I mean, it's like you feel that process, kind of painful.
Yeah, I mean, there's things, it's a goofy movie, but it is, these things, it's not easy to watch. That scene you're talking about in the tea house, it's not easy to watch that, because you see her, the scene where she's feeding herself, and it's sort of this moment of joy where she's like stuffing her face, and it's this very innocent thing, and it goes from there to her having that really horrible physical transformation, and then to being lynched. It's not real comfortable viewing, and it's hard to completely you can just say it's a WTF movie and distance yourself from it that way, but if you let it, it can definitely engage you on an emotion.
Yeah, it's more raw emotions, and like it's a really big contrast to General Invincible, which at times tries to be really heady.
Yeah.
And so I think they're complete opposite type films of what they represent. But like Wolf Devil Woman is just all, everything's raw and right there.
General Invincible sometimes seems like it's trying to be like a touch of Zen or something like that. Like it's trying to get all spiritual and kind of psychedelic, which.
I really like that though. I agree with you. I think of all our films, it's sort of the most flawed in that it doesn't quite achieve, I think, what it was trying to do. But I think in some ways it was trying to be a sort of opus film for her.
Oh, yeah, that comes across.
Because there's some wonderful, amazing, intense Baroque scenes. There's that crucifixion scene or the scene where she finds out about her father's death, and she's at this point, I guess we're talking about General Invincible right now. She, you know, wants to retreat from the martial arts world, gets called back because her father was killed, doesn't want to, wants nothing to do with revenge, but is sort of shamed into it by her father's advisor who commits suicide. And then
That's a pretty intense scene.
she's
We're
like,
all
she's calling
laughing.
him, you know, stupid, like, why did you do this? Why did you do this? And then she's like, has this epileptic attack, and the advisor, like, why are you such
Foaming at
a
the
weird
mouth.
person, you know? And you can tell, again, she plays this character who's the surrogate eldest son. She's been put in this role, and this guy's like, why are you so useless? Why won't you, you know, avenge your father? And then he kills himself to guilt trip her. And then there's this amazingly beautiful scene where she takes the severed hand of her father, who was out picking chrysanthemums, his favorite flower, these yellow chrysanthemums, takes it with these chrysanthemum flowers, and she's in this like really cool like samurai gear, throws it up in the air and like twirls her sword really fast and chops into little pieces like her father's hand mixed up with all these little pieces of flowers as they fall to the floor. And it's like, wow, that was just amazing.
Yeah, and that's I think there's in a lot of her films there's that she has this sort of I mean I think the scene where she gets lynched and thrown down the well in Wolf Devil Woman she has these sort of moments of martyrdom, but I think yeah it's definitely the most explicit in General Invisible because she literally is crucified, and that's sort of the thing that brings her to the next level too, right? There's like she has to
She has like a
cross
vision.
the threshold between life and death because she keeps having this image of her master telling her that she has to cross that threshold to get to the next level. And then there's like rivers flowing backwards. There's all these, she has this like crazy psychedelic vision while
Yeah, it's
she's
almost like this Alexander Jodorowsky film, you
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's like El Topo or something like that. It's really pretty, it's pretty intense and crazy.
Yeah, my one complaint about the film is my one big complaint is the music. They just grab stuff from various sources, and I think one person said some of it's from like one of the opening scenes of Conan. And it's sometimes the music goes well with the scenes, actually surprisingly well, because they've got this one sort of very much like opera style. Maybe that's the one from Conan. Musical cue, but then sometimes it just doesn't fit with the scene because it's totally like they threw it on, and if it works, it's totally by chance. And
At least they don't use any James Bond music in
yes,
it. You know, there's that.
I think Nick, you said in your review, I mean, there are a couple scenes which just come off as being really pretentious, and I think it, they just did not, for whatever reason, handle those scenes well. I don't know. There, this film was directed by what's his name,
All right, who did?
Cheng Peng Yi,
Yeah.
who's done some other Wuxia films, which I haven't seen, so I can't really say anything about him. So I don't know if there was conflict on the set or if it was just sort of a poor script.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much of the script has problems because I've only seen the dub version, so I don't know how much of the philosophical stuff gets muddled up to make it sound like more just random mumbo jumbo too with.
This was a hard one to find information about because it's not in the Hong Kong Film Archive database. It's not in the Taiwan Film Database. And I finally found on the Gulong forum someone had this promotional material for the film that had the credits, and I discovered that the writer was this famous Wuxia novelist called Du Guhong, and he was been writing since the early 60s, and this film is based on a book of his called the English translation is Angry Sword, Wild Flower, which a TV series that Pearl directed in 1985. And so this film is maybe it's more like the final chapter of the book. I kind of think that's the case. It's a bit of a mess, but I think there's just some really remarkable scenes, like the scenes with her master, who's in these like cool purple robes in this dark lit chamber, and with some of those, I didn't quite know what's going on, but he's got these, I don't know if they're pupils or minions or whatever, who've had their soul taken away from them. I'm never really quite sure what's going on in this movie. And again, you know, who knows whether it's because of the dubbing or the script or, but to me, it's still got a lot to recommend.
I'd say too. One thing I have to say about this movie is that the costumes in this movie are amazing.
Yeah.
If everybody looks like they're dressed for like an Adam and the Ants video.
Yeah.
There's like lots of sort of powdered wigs, and like, it's sort of like glam, sort of Ziggy and Spiders from Mars meets, I don't know, you know, the court of Louis the 14th. Or something, lots of puffy sleeves, shiny clothes.
Compared
pillows.
It to like a Ken Russell film, and you're.
Yeah, it's definitely got that kind of very kind of campy. I mean, it's definitely got like this very kind of campy gay sensibility to the way that the characters are dressed, and very different. I mean, it's definitely got that Pearl touch, and that the costuming is super eccentric, but it's eccentric in a different way from her other movies. Other of her movies, the costuming is kind of funky, and this one, it's all very elaborately over the top. But very visually, it definitely gives the film a very distinctive visual stamp to it.
And it's interesting, this director the same year, the director is Zhang Pengyi. Mm-hmm. He directed a film that came out the same year called Three Famous Constables, which stars Pearl Chang as one of the constables. And that's a very cool film. I mean, it's got this great sort of spaghetti Western look to it. And very moody, very consistent tone, and it's interesting to see two films by the same director that look so different, and so you can see like what is sort of Pearl's influence and
good point,
and what is this other director's style, and what was also interesting when I rewatched it is, even though it was really cool, because Pearl had sort of a toned down, more serious role, or one that would seem like not so much her own role. Mm-hmm. It just didn't grab me as much as her films. And I think that's what's great about her films, is she puts so much of herself into it. And that's the thing, I guess. If you don't like her, you're not going to like her films.
Yeah, that's definitely.
But, you know, if she strikes some kind of chord with you, then you'll love them as flawed as they are, you know?
Right. You won't be able to get enough of them. And, you know, because a lot of these films we've watched, I definitely got hooked on her. And it's led me to a lot of films I wouldn't have otherwise watched that weren't that great. But I just kind of watched them for her presence. And then she always makes it worthwhile.
1983, this is getting towards the end of her career. The other film that came out that year is The Dark Lady of Kung Fu, which I know we all have sort of very opinions on its merits. I love this one because this is the one where I've read at least three reviews, and where I'm going to just, since I have it in front of me and I think it's hilarious, I'm going to quote this review from IMDb, which informs us that, let me tell you one thing, do not be misled by the title. This movie does not, this is in caps, this movie does not contain kung fu. And then so he describes the movie and how weird it is, and then, so in conclusion, let me just speak on behalf of everyone who has seen this movie by saying simply, what? With lots of exclamation points and question marks, and
The life of the kung fu movie purist is kind of like being one of the protagonists in a Pearl Chang Ning movie. It's like just doomed to a life of endless disgruntlement and disappointment, I think.
Yeah.
I'd rather be open to the version of kung fu that's presented in this movie than kind of pick it apart based on any kind of strident technical standards. But
wait, so,
Go ahead.
Of course, the Chinese title is nothing to do with the English title. It translates
Right.
as like shadowless butterfly, which is her character, that like the no shadow butterfly.
Yeah.
But they had to sell it in the West somehow, so.
Right. Yeah.
Right. This movie is actually when I realized the first time I took a pass at it, I didn't even finish it, which gives you some idea of what I thought of it the first time I watched it. The second time, which I watched it, which was just last week, and I'm glad I finished it. It's definitely inspired by the Shaw Brothers movie, The Black Butterfly, but it definitely departs from it in a lot of ways too. But there's I think it's a Lo Wei movie, 1968 Shaw Brothers movie, which is su supposedly also based on The Black Rose. It takes its inspiration, the character she plays is from that movie, but it definitely goes off on some tangents from that.
Yeah, it's a
Yeah.
totally different film.
It's
Like
more lonely.
I was thinking, to me it reminds me, and this is actually a little surprising, that when I was looking at the Taiwan box office for 1982, number four was Miracle Fighters by Yuen Wu-ping, which I haven't even seen, but I know it's a really crazy film, and I was surprised that it scored so highly in the box office, which shows, I don't know, the kind of films that are Taiwan people like. But it sort of
Well,
goes with the style of, wuxia films that they.
right. Well, that's the thing. This movie is you kind of set me straight about this movie, David, because one of the things that the available information on Pearl doesn't serve us really well because of the existing filmographies, like on the HKMDB and IMDb, would have you think that this was her first directorial movie when it was actually her last. And so I approached it thinking that it was like her novice directorial effort. It is more of a straightforward kung fu comedy, like Shaolin Drunkard or Miracle Fighters or something like that. It's a lot more in that vein. And it seems like such a radical, I don't know, I get this idea from her films that there is this sort of comedic sensibility that's sort of in the other, sort of in Magic Escort, it's in Wolf Devil Woman a little bit. Here, it's like a lot of the film is dedicated to straight up kind of slapstick comedy and sort of elaborate gags and just sort of shtick. That's just not to my personal taste, and I just don't
Yeah.
find it that funny.
It's definitely like the odd film out of her career.
Right.
And what I like about it, to me, it's like just kind of like her having fun.
Yes.
Because all of her other roles are definitely they feel like personal journeys where she's working out some stuff. And in this one she's just, she's like butterfly queen of this gang, cute gang of ruffians, and is like, just having fun pulling the wool over everyone's eyes, and it's just her kind of relaxing and.
Yeah, there's not really any intense aspects to this movie. There's not really a tragic undercurrent to it. And yeah, and the scenes with her gang of the monkeys, they reminds me of the Bowery Boys or the little or Our Gang or something like that. It's almost like something out of a Max Sennett comedy. And then the fight scenes, I mean, I love the stuff where she's the butterfly, like the first scene where she's literally flying around and climbing along the ceiling like an insect. I mean, that stuff's amazing. It's really fun. I think it's just that it's a really, the reason I thought it was her first movie was just because it's so inconsistent as far as the storytelling. It really doesn't seem to have much of a framework, and it
Yeah,
dedicates such a
there's.
large part of the movie to shtick, and then at the end, it's like, okay, but we're also going to tell this really complicated sort of wuxia narrative with all these different characters and all these rivalries and concealed identities, and it becomes very hard to follow.
I think one of the reasons for that is it's not really hers. She's credited as a writer, but it's not her story, in that the story's not about her character. You know what I mean? The real sort of the conflict is about these other characters. She's sort of an outsider, helping out, but.
Right, but it spends the first 45, 50 minutes of the movie just focusing exclusively on her character. So I guess it's just if you're used to a certain kind of narrative, I guess.
But if you want to see, like, Pearl taking a bath in a clamshell in her like funky strawberry shortcake outfit, and then this is definitely, the movie for you. What I also like is it's kind of you see her at her sort of most surreal in, yes, this film.
Yeah, and a lot of it, it's her setting up stuff just to show how cool she is, with how she's, yes, the better fighter than everybody, and she's smarter than everybody, and all the authority figures are comically stupid or comically evil.
Right, there's a lot of bumbling authority figures. Definitely.
Yeah, and even her allies, she tricks them into dressing up as versions of the Black Butterfly while she's off in her own disguise running her own scam while they're off,
right,
fighting the bad guys. So.
Yeah, and there's definitely a lot of cool... I liked her. She has that stone automaton, the guy with the big pestle who she controls, sort of this big puppet. So yeah, there's a lot of really crazy stuff in the movie. And it also, there's a version, I mean, you probably have the same thing, Tars, where it's the VCD that has the English dub on one channel and the Chinese language on the other channel that you have to switch. The English dub is atrocious, but it has like some pretty hilarious,
yeah, the awful parts. Puns.
Oh yeah, and the people who dubbed this movie just did not care at all. And so you have characters called Laurel and Hardy,
yeah,
and characters called Cool Han Luke.
Yeah.
And the magician is called Houdini.
Yeah.
And then there's, I mean, I love, you know, my favorite line, there's the character called No Name, which who knows what the Chinese language part was, but there's the part where he goes, piss off. I told you before. My name is No Name. My surname is No. My name is Name. So cut the bullshit. Best line ever.
Yeah.
So yes, there are things to recommend, Dark.
Yeah, I would recommend it for the cool costumes, and there's still some nice, surprising, weird, violent touches. Like when, so there's the one of the villains is developing this cannon, mm-hmm, and then when they finally attack him, they throw all these gold,
the,
you know,
tails,
nuggets,
or whatever you call it.
Yeah, those gold tails, the gold ingots, and to the cannon, and fire it at him, and they get embedded, you know, into his face. And
right, that's intense.
Yeah.
Irony, yeah.
Right, exactly.
And then that weird little scene where that piece of the blue rose or the blue flower ring is one of the guys is like sewing it into his body.
Right.
You know, while the kids are looking through this little peephole, you know, and you just see their eye. You know, you go back and forth between them, their eyes looking in, and then he discovers that he's being watched, and you see his eye, you know, looking back out at them. And it's got some nice little odd touches. And
sure.
Yeah.
Just not my favorite. I enjoyed it more when I watched it the second time, but just not. There's a lot of her films that I would recommend over that one, but
definitely I think probably maybe my last to recommend, unless it's to a really strange person.
Right, so this is how you can determine whether Dave likes you or not.
I put it slightly above General Invincible, but that's just because I didn't like a little bit of General Invincible, but I'll get more in depth on that when I have notes with the specific things I had problems with on an actual review. But
I think General Invincible has become fonder to me in memory than it was at the time. I don't think I really loved it either. But then when I think back of it, I just think of all the weird costumes and strange effects. I mean, she's another one where her movies are kind of like that. So like even some of the bad ones, just they're so crazy that when you think back on them, they're... It has the magic lizard effect where you think they're a lot better than they actually are. And then you trick yourself into watching them again and you find, no, they're, well, wasn't that good.
Mm-hmm. Well, so this was sort of the last year of her film career. And she also made Three Famous Constables, which I mentioned. And then, of course, the also notorious fantasy Mission Force.
She's one of the greatest films ever made by anyone,
right,
ever.
Where she plays small roles, kind of almost, I didn't watch the whole thing, but because she's kind of like Jackie Chan's like stage manager, right? Because doesn't she bring it to this boxing match, you know?
Yes, right. She's sort of like the Burgess Meredith character to his mm-hmm. Rock. That's true. She's kind of a hustler character in that.
Yeah,
it's a good role for her, actually.
Yeah, and she looks cool in her outfit, and I mean, this was, from what I understand, a total gangster picture where everyone
right,
starts coerced into making
right.
it.
Yeah.
Everyone was performing in it for fear of their lives.
But the other sort of noteworthy rumor to come out of this is that Jackie and Pearl were romantically involved, and probably, like he's done to so many other starlets, he just dumped her after he was through with her. But who knows what really happened? But they starred together in this film, you know, small roles, but he was sort of at his rising to his heights of star at the time.
Yeah, this is sort of like this is sort of the mad world of kung fu comedies, because there's a lot of, you know, Wang Yu's in it and Jackie Chan. And I mean, it's another one of those what the fuck movies where everyone is like, I agree, you know, this movie's so crazy, but it is important to remember it is a comedy, you know, above all else.
Yeah,
so
it's
not
crazy on purpose.
Right. It's not supposed to be taken seriously.
It's kind of like the, you know, the Stephen Chow movies. I can't remember when he started making movies, but it's, you know, these kind of nonsense, non sequitur comedies, you know, they just throw everything plus the kitchen sink into it.
Yeah. I mean, this is the movie, if people don't know about it, if there's anybody who would listen to this podcast who wouldn't know what Fantasy Mission Force is, but this is a movie that's ostensibly set in World War II, but I think the subplot is that Abraham Lincoln is involved somehow.
Yeah, he's kidnapped. He and other generals are kidnapped by the Japanese. So.
Right, and then then the Nazis drive like 70s muscle cars, and I guess you could look at it as sort of another, you know, alternative history kind of fiction a little bit.
It's what he did after he hunted the vampires.
Right, exactly. Poor Abraham Lincoln. But he's in every reality, he still made it to the theater on time, unfortunately. But I guess it's noteworthy for it being her last film, right? She did TV afterwards. Right?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the exact chronology. I kind of prefer to think of General Invincible as her last film, because I know Fantasy Mission Force was like a Chinese New Year film, which puts it out in, like, you know, February or March.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, General Invincible is kind of sort of her final statement, especially with that character of wanting to leave the martial arts world.
Right.
But then in 1985, she made this, I'm not sure, 30 episode TV series based on the same book, Angry Sword Wildflower. And there are episodes on the various Chinese video sites. I watched the pilot once, but with no subs, it's kind of hard to make out what's going on. And of course, being TV, the production values are noticeably less, so it really depends on the story that's
right
be watching it.
Is
so.
the costuming still crazy, or
it's a little toned down? I think maybe she realized for a TV show she needed to tone it down for the mainstream, or maybe she was doing something different. It's sort of hard to evaluate. But after this show, I have no idea what happened to her, and no one
That was going to be my next question, because one of the commenters on my site just this week asked, do you know what she's done since she did these films? And I said, no, I don't. I don't know if anybody knows except for her.
Pearl, if you're listening, give us a call.
One writer on the Gulong forum said that she moved to Canada. And then I've also read in the forums rumors that she was in trouble with the triads, and we can see in her characters this sort of, she didn't quite fit in with the entertainment world. So, you know, she just disappeared as mysteriously as one of her characters, you know.
In my ideal world, she'd be co-owning the Chinese restaurant with Polly Shang Kwan.
That would be cool.
I hope she's doing well wherever she is. I mean, she wouldn't. You said she was born in 55, so she wouldn't even be that old right now. So, Dave, a question I want to ask you in the course of, I know we don't ever give these episodes of the Infernal Brains specific names, but I did think if we did a good name for it, might be Down the Rabbit Hole with Pearl Chain.
Nice, I like that.
Because she actually, in Wolf Devil Woman, there is that scene where she actually goes down the rabbit hole after the rabbit. I was going to ask you if in the course of doing all this research and sort of falling into this Pearl Changeling K-hole, if you ever felt like Dana Andrews and Laura, did you have like nightmares about Pearl Chang, you know, wake up screaming her name, or, you know, did it alter your consciousness?
It did alter my consciousness, because when I first watched Wolf Devil Woman, I was actually in the middle of having chicken pox at the time.
Right, I remember.
And it was just this suitably monstrous state to like be introduced to her films. And I don't know if that had anything to do with me sort of falling for her, but I do notice that throughout this, I felt very protective about her, and I almost feel like a little chip on her shoulder, on my shoulder, like I imagine she might have had, you know, this sort of this need to prove herself. And I think for me, what I wanted to do with my whole project I'm building around her is shaking up the sort of image she has for Western fans, and just dumping out all the information I can find, and just hopefully getting people to sort of reevaluate her, and you know, hopefully getting her some new fans. I don't know how likely that is. Sometimes seems to me not too likely, but
I think we can get her some new fans.
Yeah,
at least,
I definitely think she deserves more due, because she's kind of been sort of ignored within sort of official, like, say, Taiwan history of their films. Because if you go to Taiwan Archive film site, she's not listed among the list of famous actors. I mean, you have Xu Feng, who was in all King Hu's films, and she also became a producer and very respectable. I mean, she produced, you know, all these art films from the mainland, like Farewell My Concubine, and totally respected lady. And then even Polly Kwan is listed there, and she's also among from the King Hu camp. But Pearl is just not, you cannot really find information about her except in these like old magazines, or I found a lot of stuff at the Gulong Forum.
Yeah, no, that's not right. The importance of just her being a director of these kind of films, and then on top of that, the fact that these, she had such a distinctive voice. I mean, no one made films like her. She wasn't following any trends or anything. She was really definitely following her own muse with these films, and that's not right. She definitely deserves a lot more recognition. Whether you like her films or not, I think she is an important figure.
Yeah, cool. So hopefully this podcast will be a step in that direction.
Right. And towards our own importance too.
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
But it's definitely been a journey, you know, and I'm still uncovering stuff about her. And the Taiwan Film Archive has this amazing catalog where they've indexed some of the magazines in their collection with the names of the articles. So I've been able to find out, okay, she's in this issue of Cinema Art. Now I know what to look for on eBay, and I've contacted some of my sellers to see if they can track down some magazines. So what's interesting too is the least documented part of her career in Chinese language material is her auteur films, right? We know all about her hit TV series from the Chinese sources, but that most interesting period is just only really written about in the West, kind of ironically.
That is interesting.
And as much as I sometimes, I have this love-hate relationship with Western fandom, the one thing I really love about them, despite all the kind of cultural misunderstandings, is just their enthusiasm for Pearl, and the people who love her really love her. And
I think there's something about her that definitely gets to you. I think I mean, I think that it was Keith at Teleport City who first hit me to Pearl, when I was just a commenter on, when back in the days when Teleport City actually had a forum before there was Twitter. I remember getting in discussions about weird kung fu movies, and he suggested sort of the holy triumvirate of Wolf Devil Woman, Matching Escort, and Miraculous Flower, and I think Dark Lady of Kung Fu, and I immediately bought all of those and watched them in a weekend and definitely was hooked, definitely got sucked in. Yeah, she's, it's, yeah, once you get into it, it's either, if you're not completely put off, you know, which is going to happen almost immediately, if you make it past the threshold, yeah, the chances that you're going to be sucked in and obsessed is are high. Yeah.
I hate to use like the inevitable drug reference, because like everyone uses drug references to her films, but it is true. It's kind of like it's an acid test. Either you're going to like totally hate her and be repulsed by her, or you're going to totally love her.
Yeah, and there's a high probability, if you're a regular reader of any of our stuff, that you'll love her films.
Yeah, I feel safe in saying that. And also, if you're repulsed by her, you're a jerk also.
Yeah, I am H-O.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's been a pleasure having you joining us once again as a guest brain.
Yeah, Dave. Thanks for having me. I don't know if any of my other obsessions will cause us to cross paths again, but I always have a great time on your show. It's a lot of fun.
Well, we love having you.
Yeah. We probably have a couple of things we can assign you to get obsessed over.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, I definitely turned to I knew I was doing the right thing when I was writing that Wolf Devil Woman piece, and I asked you to help me get more information on her. And both you guys actually are like rock stars of research. I mean, I feel like I do okay, but you guys are both like amazing researchers. You always manage to dig up really interesting information. So I'm sure there's just endless vistas of things for us all to get obsessed with.
That's the great thing about obsession
and codependency.
Yeah,
definitely. All right then.
So the discussion of Pearl finally comes to a close after the double-sized extra brains episodes. So join us next time and next genre as we discuss some other film that you just will have to track down as soon as you hear about it.
If you enjoyed this show, please do let us know, even if, like you always say, Tars, even if it is just to tell us that we suck. We like to hear that someone out there in that lonely cyberspace is listening to what we have to say.
Right. And also, we got to make sure that people check out Dave's many properties out there. He has the blog Soft Film. Is that a softfilm.blogspot.com?
Yes, and so okay. Soft Film has been taken over by Pearl Chang a month ago.
Yes.
And probably for at least another month. I've got a lot more things I want to write about, and then I also have a Tumblr devoted to her called Fuck Yeah Pearl Chang with an exclamation point. Although definitely that's not in the address. But if you Google enough, you will find it.
David, I forgot to ask you. Now, you are going to publish, because you've done sort of an alternative filmography for Pearl, which you feel pretty confident about the dates being more accurate as opposed to what's out there. You're going to publish that, aren't you?
I'm going to put that on my blog. It will probably be up by the time this episode is aired.
Awesome. Yeah, so cool. The more reason to check out Soft Film.
That way the people have a choice to who to argue about the release dates with.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
Although really there is no choice.
Yeah.
Listen to IMDb, even Hong Kong Movie Database has its problems. And I'm not saying mine doesn't have problems either, but And I have, if you want sources too, I will give them to you, but I'm not necessarily going to put them on.
It's annotated.
I was thinking of doing that, actually. See.
So wrapping it up.
Thanks for joining us on this journey through Pearl's films. And until next time in next genre, the Infernal Brains are checking out.
See ya.
Bye.